Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee is a definitive moment in U.S. history. But what exactly does it define? Many scholars have interpreted the butchering of at least 150 tribal members as a marker in history. For some, Wounded Knee has become symbolic of the death of a culture, the closing of a frontier, and the end of an era. That analysis makes little sense when held against the light of truth about American Indians today. Native Americans are not gone or decimated. David Troyer's new book is called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Troyer is a member of the Ojibwe tribe from Minnesota. He holds a PhD in anthropology, and he joins us for a look at changing that narrative. David Troyer, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
As we look at this book and then so many cultural portrayals of the narrative of Native Americans being a conquered people, being, reservations being lands of suffering and woe, how often do you really see that in popular culture, in media representations, in policies? How pervasive is that knowledge or that narrative, I mean?
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It's everything from movies like Wind River to, works by Native people like Smoke Signals. We feel it, Native folk, at least I do, we feel this in our regular lives. I can't tell you how many times I've had the same conversation in the course of my life. And I kind of feel like I need a t-shirt that says, yes, I am. Yes, we are. No, we're not. And to answer the usual questions, which are, yes, I'm Native. Yes, we're still alive. No, you didn't kill all of us. And it seems silly, but, so many Native people, I think, have the same kind of experience where there's a profound cognitive dissonance that most Americans experience when we force them to recognize that not only are we still here, but we're not just here suffering. We're here doing stuff. We're here making our own history, and that's hard for people to get sometimes.
Talk about the importance of understanding that history, but then how that narrative is told, how it is sort of presented to students, to moviegoers and to readers. How does that make a difference in how you see yourself?
Well, I am too much of a literature professor to feel other than the fact that words shape the world. The kinds of stories we tell, the kinds of narratives that we use generally and in all ways to narrate and understand our experience, those narratives shape what we think of as real and possible, and so they shape our reality and in turn shape our future. The problem, of course, for me and for a lot of other Native folk is that the only narrative that is used to narrate and thus to understand Indian life is a tragic narrative. That's it. We were once great people, but we're great no more. Reservations are no places. They're just basins of perpetual suffering. And you all in South Dakota know this only too well. If the national media turns its attention to Native issues, it always turns to Pine Ridge, and it's always a tragic story. Or very occasionally, it's the opposite side of the tragic coin. It's a story of hope. And this happens all the time. I mean, I remember a photographic essay in The New Yorker called Postcards from Pine Ridge. This was it. Yeah. Do you remember this?
I do remember this, yeah.
Aaron Huey. And I was so mad when that came out because in that photographic essay, there's all the usual things. There's a homeless guy. There's a guy with substance abuse problems. There's a kid on a horse, but the kid's kind of messed up or something. And then I swear to you, there's a picture of a girl standing, I think, in a diaper and a t-shirt on a pile of garbage. And that's sort of the best example of the tragic narrative, which dominates the ways people think about us. Because I know, because I'm Native, and I've got friends from Pine Ridge, that there may have been a girl in that circumstance, sure. Maybe he didn't pose her there, although maybe he did. But I know that there are hundreds of other girls at Pine Ridge who are playing basketball and doing their homework and selling Girl Scout cookies and not standing in piles of garbage.
I've heard it called poverty porn. I've heard that phrase before, where people are just looking for something.
I call it trauma porn.
Yeah.
And this is true for Dee Brown's classic, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which is the best-selling book about American Indian history ever published. And Brown was a really sympathetic outsider, a really seems like a really amazing man who dedicated a huge chunk of his life to telling the story of Native American history. But on the very first page of that book, he says, "This book is about the Plains Wars, and I focus on the Plains tribes, and I start in 1850, and I end in 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee," and now I'm quoting, "where the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed, period." And then one page later, he says, "And so if you happen to travel to a contemporary Indian reservation and notice the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, perhaps by reading this book, you will understand why." Hmm. And I read that book when I was in college, and I was so upset because on one hand, I felt happy that he was drawing attention to us. And on the other hand, I felt completely silenced and gagged because in the very first pages, he announced our death. And so I wanted to write a book, which is this book now, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, which starts in 1890 and has the opposite thesis, which is that 1890 was a very low point. That massacre was heartbreaking. But a book that starts there and moves to the present day and investigates the ways in which we haven't just been victims of history, but we've been making our own history as best we can over the last 128 years.
And one of the ways that you deal with that massacre itself is by looking at, one of the other challenges is this becomes a block of people. You know, these people were massacred, these women, these children, and they ceased to exist as individuals. And individuals who had, stories to tell and relationships with one another and futures and pasts. And so part of your book is sort of picking apart that narrative to sort of look at people as individuals. And I'm wondering, tying that into something that you just said about, how Native Americans have been treated in the past. Talk about getting people to tell you stories and to trust you and, to open up about their lives today because they're not sure who you are in the beginning. How did you sort of approach that?
Yeah. Well, there are two answers kind of wrapped up in the question you asked. So the book that I wanted to write was going to be about Native American life, not Native American death. So that was important. That was an important thing for me to remember. And just moving forward from the massacre, as much loss as was incurred at the massacre, more people survived than died. And that's sort of my guiding principle is, of course, we recognize our losses and our challenges, but I want to focus on the living. And I think the opposite of tragedy is not hope. I think the opposite of a tragic narrative is a narrative that considers our complexity and depth and the layers and contradictions that attend our lives. Because tragedy washes everything out and it turns people, like you put it, into blocks and reduces history to just a tabulation of pain and of suffering. And so to counteract that, I had to go out, as you note, and talk to people. If this book is going to be a book about American Indian lives, and it's not about American Indian life because there's no such thing. There are only American Indian lives because there's so much diversity. There's no one story of us from any period in time. But I had to go out and talk to people, and it was something I'd gotten used to doing in my last book, which was Res Life, which is about reservations and for those of us who are from them, what they mean and why they exist and where they're going. And I had to do a lot of interviews for that book. And when I did that book, I was super nervous. I didn't know how to do it. And I'm kind of shy by nature. And for this book though, I kind of knew how to do it. And I lucked out. I met so many interesting people who once they understood, and it didn't take long, once they understood what I was asked her and what I wanted the book to be were so generous with their time and with their lives. But I think it also helps that I'm in the book.
Right.
It didn't feel right to ask people to share their lives with me and to expose themselves and incur some risk unless I wasn't, it wasn't fair to ask that unless I also asked that of myself. So there's an inward journey too. And I kind of put myself on the line.
So tell me,
I'm not going to just ask a bunch of people to put themselves on the line and not do it myself.
So tell me about that, because there's lots of things in this book that as you're writing it, you know, you talk about the American Indian movement and the nuances of the leadership and some of the violence that ensues. You talk about stereotypes of, you know, casinos, and these are not necessarily easy topics. But then you also talk about yourself and your own relationships. What felt the riskiest to you as you put this book together?
What felt the riskiest?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a good question. There are a lot of the people I talk to. I mean, talking about the virtues and vices, say, to put it mildly, of the leadership of the American Indian Movement back in the 70s didn't feel that risky. All of that stuff is a matter of the public record, so that was fine. And there might be pushback, and that's okay. But the riskiest felt... I felt the most unsure about the portraits of people that appeared in the book. I was talking to this one man who was a Blackfeet guy, and he was a rodeo guy. He was a bull rider, then a bronc rider for years, a really gifted guy, and named Dave Schilt. And for instance, I mean, I describe him as being incredibly sad. And so when I assessed his life, or when I don't know how to put it, but when I wrote the parts where I kind of come up, not with a value judgment, of course, but with an assessment of who he is and what his life means, and I know he's going to read it. I mean, those kinds of moments, I feel very conscious of the fact that people trust me, and I have to earn that trust. I have to deserve it, but I also have to say something true. I can't just... The book can't just be a big group hug where everyone's awesome. I had to say things that are true, even difficult things about moments, but also about people. And that always makes me, I'm very conscious of the fact that something hangs, something is hanging in the balance there.
Yeah.
That's a little nerve wracking.
You said earlier that words shape the world, and we really only have about a minute left, but I want to talk about the word.
Oh, no.
The word, I know we should have given you an hour to have this conversation,
right?
But I want to talk about the word, you're always welcome back. The word and, in the sense that you can be Ojibwe and Native American and American, and it's not this notion of just, you know, one, like, who are you, and you have to pick this this one thing. Do you find that's a revolutionary concept for a lot of people when they think about people from tribes and reservations and Native Americans, that there's this great and that makes a huge difference in someone's life?
Of course, and that's the thing is that most Native American people are only understood as being one thing, and that is basically representatives of suffering and a sort of signpost to point to America's worst acts. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to remember the ands. We have a difficult history, and we have vibrant cultures. We have poverty and crime, and we have creativity and tribal sovereignty and hustle. And we are Native, and we are American, and we are men and women, and we are modern and ancient. We're all these things at once. Identity is multiple and overlapping for everybody.
David Troyer.
My kids think of themselves as Ojibwe and Fortnite players. So, there you go.
There you go. One of many ands. The book is called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. David Troyer, we hope to have you back. And now I have discovered all these other books that you've written that I did not know existed. So I'm pretty excited about that discovery as well. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.